From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, if you've served time in prison and think you cannot vote, you can.
We're working really hard to make sure that folks in Michigan who have a criminal background, who have been incarcerated or are on probation or parole, do know that they have the right to vote.
Dear Black Women, a network of affirmation for Black women in Southeast Michigan.
This is a community of very, very, very richly talented, eager people who are in need of more access to resources and opportunities.
Camp Kid Power, helping preschoolers face anxiety.
We're trying to build what is known as the frontal cortex, that part of the brain that's right behind your eyes, to sort of feel the fear and do it anyways.
And the Michigan Pirate Festival.
And we're going to do Powder Monkey Olympics and pillaging with pirates.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Last Friday, we were out on the street asking people if they plan to vote in tomorrow's primary election. One man's comment was particularly striking.
My name is Eric, and I'm from the great city of Ypsilanti, Michigan. I would love to vote in the primary election on August 7th. So, unfortunately, I'm unable to vote because I am currently on parole through the Michigan Department of Corrections, and I honestly feel that it is unfair that we don't have the right to vote.
Well, we immediately got a message from Alan Wachendorfer. He's with the Michigan chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. And Alan is a formerly incarcerated person who's a founding member of a group called Nation Outside. Alan, welcome. Good to have you with us.
I'm glad to be here.
So what is it that you want Eric to know about being formerly incarcerated and voting?
I want Eric to know he does have the right to vote in Michigan. Although he probably needs to re-register to vote, he still has time to do that for the November election. If he's not currently registered, he won't be able to vote tomorrow. But just because he has a felony record does not mean he has lost that right.
So I'm interested, how widespread is this misconception that felons can't vote?
Well, it's very widespread, and for good reason, because nationally, about 1 in 40 people have been disenfranchised by laws that tell people who have a criminal record that they cannot vote. But that's not true in Michigan. Fortunately, we have the ability to vote. Once you are done serving your time from incarceration, you can re-register and your rights are restored automatically.
So why do you think there is so much confusion over this?
Well, it's tough because every single state is different. Some states, there are two in the nation, you can vote while you're incarcerated. Other states, you can vote once you're done with incarceration. Others, you do lose your rights while you're on probation and parole. And then there's a few yet that are even stricter where you lose your rights forever. And what that has caused is a huge amount of disenfranchisement. I mean, like I said already, 1 in 40 people nationally have lost their right to vote. And that number is even bigger for the African-American population, which is 1 in 13. But at Nation Outside, we're working really hard to make sure that folks in Michigan who have a criminal background, who have been incarcerated or are on probation or parole, do know that they have the right to vote. All they have to do is register. In fact, people who are in jail who have not been sentenced yet, they also can vote absentee.
I guess that patchwork quilt of laws really has led to a lot of misconception. Any idea, like, how many people we might be talking about, how many votes that we could be missing?
I would guess at least in the tens of thousands and probably even more because, I mean, there are almost 40,000 people incarcerated in Michigan now, and thousands get released every year. And so the number could really be huge.
Now, your story, you are someone who was formerly incarcerated, right?
I am.
And so what was the path that led you to found Nation Outside?
So we started Nation Outside because we realized that a group of us formerly incarcerated people got together. We realized that there were a lot of conversations going on, fortunately, about criminal justice reform. We saw that a lot of people were talking about how, you know, this system is not working. It's broken. It needs to be fixed. But what we realized at the same time was there weren't any groups out there that represented formerly incarcerated people themselves. And we wanted to have a seat at that table because people who have lived through the system really know best on how to fix that system. And so our goal is to be part of the conversation about criminal justice reform and to get other people, as they get released from prisons, get them engaged civically, either voting or at the policy table, reforming the system so that it works better and doesn't disenfranchise people.
And Alan, tell us about the specific choice of those terms, formerly incarcerated person or returning citizen. What message do those terms send as compared to parolee or ex-convict?
Well, words like parolee or ex-convict defines us by our worst mistake. So we want to flip that and be known as citizens. We are citizens too. So a lot of us refer to ourselves as returning citizens, but people that have been out for quite a while, I've been out for 10 years now. I've moved to using the term formerly incarcerated person, or just call me Alan. Call me, you know, what you would call any other person. But in the context of a conversation like this, we prefer formerly incarcerated because that shows that that's part of our past. That's not who we are anymore. We're a different person now, and we're moving forward.
And how have you seen, Alan, this greater involvement with the formerly incarcerated? How do you see that affecting communities as people do kind of dig in and start really speaking up?
Well, it impacts communities because we're all going to be your neighbor. There are so many people that are getting released from prison on a daily basis or from jail. We're going to be your neighbor. And so, giving us the allowing us access to the tools that we need to be successful is in the best interest of everyone, because we're coming home to our communities. But when we have an opportunity to get involved, to have a second chance, to get a job, to be able to vote, to get into higher education, to be active members of society, then we do good, and then our neighborhoods do good, and our cities do good, and the people that are around us all benefit from that.
So as you say, it is too late for people to register for tomorrow's primary, but your most overarching message to any formerly incarcerated people listening who thought, like Eric, they could not vote, and that message is?
Get out there and vote. Check to see if you're registered. You can go online to the Secretary of State website and check that, and get engaged. Get registered and get out there and vote, and join Nation Outside.
Alan Wackendorfer is a founding member of Nation Outside. The group works to get people who have served time in prison engaged civically. And yes, that indeed includes voting. Thank you so much, Alan.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And now to our series on campfire stories. We turn to a classic urban legend, the legend of Bloody Mary. Jennifer Strauss is a professional storyteller based in Traverse City, and here she is telling the version she heard as she grew up.
So when I was growing up, urban legends were a big deal, and we told them to each other all the time. We loved being scared. There was something about it. And those urban legends were passed around as if they had happened to a friend of yours. So this is a story that I need to tell you about a sleepover at my house when I was young. And so Julie and Kathy were always the best friends who slept over on a Friday night. And when everybody in my house had gone to sleep, and we had eaten all the pizza and drank way too much Coca-Cola, we would head down the hallway to the bathroom in our house upstairs. And we would go in, and the three of us would crowd in front of the mirror and shut the bathroom door. And we would push Kathy out in front because she was much more brave. And the three of us would start to chant, "I do believe in Bloody Mary. I do believe in Bloody Mary." We would say it 13 times. For we had been told that if we said that 13 times in that dark bathroom in front of the mirror, Bloody Mary would appear in the mirror, but not only that, she would come out of the mirror and scratch the face of the girl who was closest to the mirror, which would make you wonder, why would you ever do this? And why did we push our good friend Kathy up closer to the mirror? Well, we had been told the story of Bloody Mary. Teenage couple coming home after the football game one night. They had stopped after the game to have a burger and some fries, and they had got busy talking so long that it had gotten late, and the boyfriend was going to get his girlfriend home after curfew. They got into the car, and he said that he knew a shortcut that would get her home a little quicker. They drove down the back roads, dirt roads, windy dirt roads, and he was traveling at a great speed, and at one point on one of the curves, he lost control of the car. The car hit a tree. Both teenagers went through the windshield. He made it, and she did not. The story tells us that Mary was such a beautiful teenage girl that after her death, this gruesome death, she didn't want anyone else to be beautiful. And so it was told to all of us that if we said her name 13 times in a mirror, she would appear and you would see that face of hers that had been disfigured by the accident. We never saw Bloody Mary. And in all the years I've told this story, there have been kids have come up to tell me that they've tried it and to also tell me why I was doing it wrong. One young man lent to us that you had to flush the toilet after you said it 13 times. Another young girl said, no, you have to say it 13 times and turn around 3 times and then look into the mirror. So we never saw Bloody Mary, but maybe some of you who have ever heard this story and have tried it have seen her.
Jennifer Strauss is a professional storyteller. Her business is Story Be Told. She travels nationally, helping educators, organizations, businesses, and people use stories to connect and communicate. Coming up, we meet the founder of Dear Black Women, an affirmation movement for Black women by Black women.
The impetus has been a lifelong journey of feeling in so many spaces throughout life that being a Black woman can often feel like being a double, triple, quadruple minority.
That's in about 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Amidst concern about animal species on the verge of extinction, we wanted to look at some success stories, species that were highly endangered but whose populations are making a comeback in Michigan. Today, the Kirtland's warbler. Dan Kennedy is the Endangered Species Coordinator for the Michigan DNR. Dan, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Cindy. Great to be here.
So tell us about the Kirtland's warbler. I'm interested in its habits and really what its role is in nature.
Sure. The Kirtland's warbler was first discovered in the United States in 1851 in Ohio. And then later, around 1900, it was discovered that its primary nesting area occurs in the northern lower Michigan. And it nests in areas where there's that are dominated by jack pine and specifically young jack pine.
Okay. And then I hear it winters in the Bahamas.
Yeah. Lucky bird.
Lucky bird.
Yeah. The primary area is the Bahamas, but there are a few other islands in the Caribbean where researchers are now looking to see if there aren't some other islands it spends the winter on.
Well, it has good taste for its winter habits. So I want to talk about the threats to the Kirtland's warbler, and you kind of touched on this. These birds are really, really fussy about where they will nest. Tell us about the kind of tree this bird must have.
Yeah, I mentioned that a little earlier. They have very specific habitat needs for nesting, and they like very young jack pine between the ages of 5 and 20 years old. And that's when the branches are low and close to the ground, and they tend to nest up under some grass cover on the ground underneath those branches. And that, around the turn of the century in 1900, that habitat was pretty abundant, because of some of the logging that was going on in the 1880s and 1890s and created some open areas and a lot of young jack pine. And so did some of our historic wildfires. Jack pine regenerates, typically would have regenerated through wildfire.
Now, there's also the brown-headed cowbird. What does that do to the Kirtland's warbler nest?
Yeah, so along with habitat, the second primary threat is parasitism by brown-headed cowbirds. And what they would do is they lay their eggs in the nest of Kirtland's warblers, and then the young end up taking over and kicking the other eggs or young birds out of the nest, and so that they're the only ones left. And it had a major impact on the number of Kirtland's warbler young that were being successfully reared.
So basically, the brown-headed cowbird is a big bully.
Yeah, a bully in nature, yep.
Yep, indeed. So how low did the Kirtland's warbler population go in Michigan? How did it bottom out, and when was that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. There was two times where the population, well, let me first say that the population is counted by the number of singing males. So in the first annual census was conducted in 1951. There was another one in 61. And then by 1971, it hit about 200 singing males. And researchers assume that there's an equal proportion of males and females, so the population was around 400. And in 1974 and 1987, there was a total of 167 singing males that were counted.
And when we were talking back in the 50s, how high was it then?
I think that the first census estimated around, I want to say, 420 singing males. So the population was estimated to be right around 1,000.
Okay, so that is a dramatic cut. And what turned things around?
Yeah, great question. And so right around in the 70s, when that 1971 census was completed, the DNR, Forest Service, and Fish and Wildlife Service got together a Kirtland's Warbler Advisory Committee. And then shortly following that, in 1973, the Endangered Species Act was signed, and the Kirtland's Warbler was one of the animal species listed. And so what happened from that was that those agencies and other organizations got together to start talking about what do we need to do to help this bird.
Really, when you think about it, intervention and land management efforts, that would take a lot of groups, a lot of agencies to work together to save the Kirtland's warbler. How many?
So back then it was primarily the federal agencies and Michigan Audubon Society. I'm sure that there's some other organizations that were involved, but I'm not sure. What I can tell you today is that we have transitioned away from the recovery team and we've gone to a Kirtland's Warbler conservation team. And there are 20 plus organizations involved in that effort.
So it's almost like this species has moved out of the intensive care unit.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it. We say it a little different. We say we're transitioning from recovery to sustainability.
So if we were to, what's the last census? So we were at that low of 167 singing males back around, like you say, 1974 to 1987. What are the numbers today?
Well, I'll clarify that it was in those 2 years that the numbers were that low. Through the rest of them in between, they were in the, you know, mid to low 200s. And around 1990 is when things started to transition. And the curve just started going straight up. And about 2001, we had about 1,000 singing males, which was the goal of the strategy. And the recovery plan was to hit 1,000 singing males. And since then, we've still been creeping upwards. And we're over 2,000 singing males as of this year.
Can you pat yourself on the back and say we have a success story here?
I would like to, but there's over, 60 years of history here, and there's a lot of people that put a lot of hard work into this prior to me coming to the DNR. So there's a long history and a lot of people who have dedicated their careers to recovering this species. So I'd like to congratulate all of those folks who put in a lifetime worth of effort into making this a reality.
So what is the lesson here in the fact that this once threatened species of bird is rebounding and is surpassed your goals?
So I would say there's several lessons. And, you know, as the endangered species coordinator, what I've learned is patience. It takes time to recover an endangered species. The second thing I've learned is the collaboration amongst state, federal, NGOs, and industry is critical. And then also the third component is that connection with the public, the making sure that we're communicating and have an outreach program that effectively reaches the people of northern Lower Michigan to keep them engaged on what we're doing.
How important, Dan, was the Federal Endangered Species Act in the comeback of the Kirtland's warbler? I mean, you've been citing it several times as we've talked.
Well, it's I think it adds that additional attention and resources necessary to implement the key conservation actions, you know, the habitat management and the controlling the cowbird parasitism. So those two things, it adds additional attention and it gives us the necessary resources to do what we need to do.
So as someone who, you know, that's your job is endangered species, working with the Michigan DNR, how concerned are you with this news that the Trump administration is looking to strip out some provisions of that Endangered Species Act?
So I've had a chance to read through some of that stuff, and my candid opinion is that it's not all bad, that there are some components in those, that some of that proposals that does streamline and make the Endangered Species Act a little more effective. And then there are some components of it that may be going too far. So I am concerned. I also think that there are some, just like anything, there's pros and cons to change. And I do think that there are both in some of those proposals.
Dan Kennedy, Endangered Species Coordinator for the Michigan DNR, with a success story of the Kirtland's warbler. Thank you so much for being with us, Dan.
Thanks, Cindy.
Around and realize you are in the minority. You could hunker down and keep to yourself, or you could take a cue from Florence Noel and create a positive space for yourself and others like you. Create a community. Florence Noel is a grad student at U of M's Ross School of Business and the School of Information. She is a woman of color. And at the Ross School, for example, minorities make up only 23% of its full-time MBA candidates, while women make up only 43%. So Florence has created Dear Black Women, DBW. It's an affirmation movement for black women by black women. Florence Noel, welcome, and it's good to have you here on Stateside.
Happy to be here, Cindy.
So to get an idea what it was like for you when you came here to Ann Arbor, to the University of Michigan, tell us about where you grew up and what that was like.
Yeah, I grew up in New York. I grew up primarily in Westchester County. That is the county right above New York City. Folks from New York City will be very, very, very serious about telling you that. And I grew up for most of my upbringing in a very, very diverse environment. It wasn't something that I noted because it was normal to have people from all over the United States and all over the world. And I was raised largely in a Haitian enclave with a pretty extensive Caribbean community as a part of my upbringing.
And here you come to Ann Arbor. What was that like for you?
So the thing is, people all often say to me, leaving New York City, where I spent a good time in Brooklyn, and coming to Ann Arbor, were you anticipating that I'll say something bad? I have nothing bad to say.
So, Dear Black Women, I see on the website an affirmation movement for black women by black women.
Yes.
What do you do? What
is it? Yeah. So, Dear Black Women started off first with our circle, which is a gathering of black women centering affirmations we've written ourselves. It sounds incredibly simple, and the entry is very simple. You write yourself a letter, you submit it in advance, and then we make an experience out of it, centering everyone's letter. And what evolved into something I thought would take no more than maybe an hour to 2 hours can become a full-day event, 6 to 8 hours, people blocking off their days. And the conversation is at once an opportunity to relieve yourself, to see yourself reflected, to get advice, to get information, to get connections. It becomes this great networking experience. From the first circle, which had five people, we've grown to over 500 in this local area and reaching over 4,000 nationally. And the vision for DBW, Dear Black Women, is to continue to build communities like this throughout the country and find ways through online communities to connect us more deeply.
So what was the impetus for founding Dear Black Women?
Yeah, the impetus has been a lifelong journey of feeling in so many spaces throughout life that being a Black woman can often feel like being a double, triple, quadruple minority, depending on additional identities you have. And it manifests in a wide range of ways that are captured in statistics when you look at the state of Black women in the country, but also in lived experiences of feeling like you're receiving microaggressions, you're not seen as the person who can lead, your voice may not be amplified, or if it is, it might be heard through a filter that has stereotypes all over it. And so this is not a recent development. It's been a lifelong journey of thinking through how you create spaces that affirm Black women and create opportunities for Black women.
Can you give me something that sticks in your mind when you were on the receiving end of this kind of microaggression that got thrown at you? You're like, where do you want to start?
I was about to say,
Come on, give us, put us in your shoes.
The examples are so extensive that it's almost painful to pull out one because none will represent all. But there have been incredible instances of leading things and having a lot of criticism come towards me where in the same situation to other people, it would not be the same. And understanding that despite working hard and seeking to achieve things at high levels, that there'll be an expectation of failure or of not being as good as you present to be as a function of being Black, as a function of being a woman, as a function of being a Black woman. And these aren't surprising. You find Black people from all genders experiences and a lot of women from all races experiences. What we often don't spend a lot of time looking at is how when you are both Black and a woman, how does that combine? These things that we're aware of people experiencing as women, people experiencing as Black people, bringing them together. Yeah.
So as you're working on your two graduate degrees and you're doing this, and this is a for-profit group?
Yes, it is.
So how is the revenue coming in and how do you want to make this a sustainable undertaking?
It's for-profit intentionally because in my experience over 10 years in nonprofit before grad school, I've just understood how often nonprofits struggle with funding the good work that they're doing. And so the challenge for me is pinning down what the revenue streams for DBW will be. As of to date, it's been largely events. In time, I want to be able to introduce membership models that can create a whole class of things that remain free and accessible despite whatever socioeconomic background you're in, but then also offer additional resources and value to people who would want to be able to pay into a membership. Beyond there, there's opportunities for partnerships and sponsorships because this is a community of very, very, very richly talented, eager people who are in need of more access to resources and opportunities. And I believe we're at a time where the people who have those access and opportunities who would like to partner. So those are some of the initial thoughts.
And age range, what are we looking at?
Largely millennial women from, I would say, the youngest has been 18. And we've gone into our 60s as well.
I was going to say, you need to get some of the women who've had a few years under
absolutely.
Their belt.
Absolutely. We have. We have. Yes. Largely because it started within the university network and branched out. It's naturally been millennial women 18 to in their mid-30s. But we have now moved in spaces where we have more women beyond that age range. And all Black women are welcome.
Flo, how do you respond to someone who might make a point? Flo, we're in America in 2018. We are way too siloed as it is.
Yeah.
Is there a validity to that argument? Could it be seen as being siloed off?
I don't know that the word silo is the accurate word. I think if we are talking about the lived realities of people based on identities, then we have to appreciate that not everyone's experience is the same. And as such, not everyone's needs are the same. It is imperative that Black women have safe spaces where they can feel reflected and affirmed. And what that enables is more connections with people who have more wholeness, more happiness, more groundedness in who they are. If people are interested in conversations across the aisle and across different identities, you want it with people who are as healthy as possible. And that's what DBW does. It does not exclude what Black women can do outside of our community, but it focuses on making sure that within our communities we get what we need so we can be better people.
How can Black women who are listening to us talk find you?
Yes! I get excited. DearBlackWomenProject.com. You'll be able to sign up, and if you're in the Southeast Michigan area, you'll get notices about events, you'll get notices about resources and affirmations and connected to the community. And if you're outside of Southeast Michigan, we're going to be branching out shortly, so stay tuned.
Florence Noel, the founder of Dear Black Women, thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you.
At Camp Kid Power, preschoolers overcome anxiety disorders through the guise of fun and play.
These are games that are meant to strengthen that something you can call broadly effortful control or inhibitory control. It's that gumption for you to be able to feel the fear and do it anyway.
That's up next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Some 20% of preschool-age kids in this country have some type of anxiety disorder. That's according to a 2014 paper published in the Journal of Clinical Adolescent Psychology. Giving these preschoolers coping techniques can certainly help as they get into and work their way through school, which is where Camp Kid Power comes in, offered by the University of Michigan Department of Psychiatry. Camp Kid Power gives children with anxiety aged 4 to 6 a fun camp experience as it teaches them skills to help them manage their anxiety. Dr. Kate Fitzgerald is with us. She is an associate professor at the U of M Department of Psychiatry. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And Melissa Bollinger is with us. She sent her son Oliver to Camp Kid Power last year. Hello, Melissa.
Hello.
So glad to have you here to talk about this. Now, Dr. Fitzgerald, we are talking about small children, ages 4 to 6. What does anxiety look like in these preschoolers? How do you define it?
Well, one of the ways that we see anxiety most commonly in this age group is when they go off to school. So it's normal. Most kids, for example, when they move from preschool or at home into kindergarten, are nervous for the first day or two or maybe even a week. But it kind of disappears. They get used to it and they start to enjoy their friends and their new teachers and the activities. Kids with clinically significant anxiety, anxiety disorders, are ones that continue to struggle much beyond the initial few days, to where sometimes you may see them just resist going to school entirely. This is the child who's out in the parking lot crying, unwilling to go into school. Some of these kids will even experience physical symptoms, vomiting, headaches, lots of stomach aches common because they're so nervous. And school is just one example. This may present in other ways, separating from a parent in other contexts, whether it's, you know, an activity that's supposed to be fun, like a birthday party, but it's just too hard to get out the door and separate.
How have you tailored Camp Kid Power for this preschooler, this youngster that has anxiety?
So one of the main treatments for anxiety across the age range, but especially for children, is something called cognitive behavior therapy. And really the key ingredient or the active ingredient for cognitive behavior therapy is something we call exposure. And exposure is basically approaching the very thing that scares you, be it school, a birthday party, a new person, you know, slowly until you feel comfortable with it. The problem with giving this type of treatment to little kids is, you know, their anxiety is sort of shouting loudly, avoid that scary thing, whatever you can do. So what we're doing with this Camp Kid Power is kind of targeting the anxiety in a different way. We're trying to build what is known as the frontal cortex, that part of the brain that's right behind your eyes, to sort of feel the fear and do it anyways. In other words, it's that gumption to say, okay, I can be persistent. Mm-hmm. I can keep trying, sort of building almost the cognitive skills.
I can do this.
That may help you, yes, overcome fears.
Okay. So, Melissa, tell us a little about Oliver. I'm wondering what kind of issues he was having that made you think, you know what, Camp Kid Power might be for us.
He was having separation issues at going to daycare when he was three. Going to preschool was fine. Like, he enjoyed riding on the bus to preschool, but in preschool, then he would act out. And we were having a lot of aggression issues of him wanting to fight because of just minor things. That was going on up until even the first month of kindergarten. And so we started seeking out help and trying to find out different ways that we could help him and help ourselves, help our family, our household.
I've got to imagine that that kind of worry and stress just filters right through the family.
Oh, yes, it does. And I was experiencing postpartum anxiety, and I was having panic attacks prior to even giving birth, and then afterwards I was having panic attacks. So I was in my own situation, and it was too hard to see that some of this could be anxiety for him. You know, that's terrible twos, it's terrible threes, it's horrible fours, whatever you associate it with their age, and
sure,
and you say, is this normal? And so some of it we didn't know what was normal and what wasn't normal. And so we sought out help to try to figure out if there's anything that, like, maybe he's got autism or maybe there's something else going on. And so we wanted to make sure that we were seeking help early enough so that if there was something that we needed to be on top of, we were trying to be on top of it.
And I'm sure as you were watching him struggle in daycare and in preschool, that had to set up a, oh boy, what if kind of scenario in your mind about him through the years.
Oh, yes. You know, like, it always seemed to be around nap time that it really seemed to be the worst. Hmm. I would fear the phone ringing at that time because I didn't know what to expect. And then thinking about it, well, is this how his whole life is going to be? I don't want him to struggle with this nervousness and aggression and anger and not knowing how to face it.
Dr. Fitzgerald, add to this if you can. How does a parent know whether a child is in a phase and will grow out of that, or this is something really deeper and more lasting?
Well, I think one thing is the persistence, the intensity, and how much is it impairing your child's function, but also something you mentioned, Cynthia, which is mm-hmm. it's really extending throughout the family. I think another way that can be very helpful is if you do happen to have your child in a preschool setting or in a kindergarten, the teachers have a pretty good sense of how does this child look relative to the other kids, and you as a parent can get that sense too. If your child is kind of standing out as, you know, everybody else is kind of getting used to school now mm-hmm. at this point, my child is still struggling, you know, that can be a red flag for maybe we need a little extra help.
So that extra help can be, part of that can be Camp Kid Power. Is this a sleepaway camp or a day camp? What's the structure?
So this is a day camp. The kids play games. They play games just like you and I and your kids and grandkids mm-hmm. have probably played. Red light, green light, Simon Says. These are games that are meant to strengthen that something you can call broadly effortful control or inhibitory control. It's the same thing that is essentially that gumption for you to be able to feel the fear and do it anyway.
So either to learn to put the brakes on or hit the accelerator at the right time.
Exactly. And with that, kind of getting used to playing games in a group environment with other kids, with new people, nice people, but these camp counselors, and learning that you can make a mistake in one of these simple games and you can get back up on your feet again and you can try again. Because making a mistake can drive a lot of anxiety in little kids.
So you're having fun, you're learning to be around other kids, but there's also therapy going on.
Yes.
It's almost kind of sneaking in the therapy while they're at camp.
Yeah, we sneak in the therapy through basically teaching the child to put a little bit of distance between themselves and the game, sort of repeat back to the camp counselor, well, what are the rules of the game? Can I talk the rules to myself out loud as I play the game, and kind of give themselves a little bit more of a distance from the emotion that they may feel when they're upset about making a mistake, and a strategy for how do I coach myself, talk myself through this?
So, Melissa, after the Camp Kid Power experience, did you see changes in your son?
Oh, most definitely. There are huge changes, and changes that even through the process of talking about it recently has made me aware of how impactful it's been. There was a big change after camp that I didn't put together, that it could have been the camp. You know, he would excuse himself when he was having trouble, and he would go put himself in the corner and calm himself down. You know, I thought it was maybe some of the stuff we were working with him, but then as I was thinking back, no, it was a lot of the control. He learned how to control, and that it was okay to feel these things and walk away and get calm. We still have anxiety with school, but he went to a camp last week and had no problem separating, you know, and had no problem going and being a part of this new experience with, he didn't know anybody. He didn't know anything about the camp, and it wasn't that easy to go to daycare.
Yes. So you're watching him going, wow, he's handling this so much better than he used to.
Yes. Yes. Oh, yeah. A year ago, we would not have been going to a camp. I would have probably had more anxiety because what's he going to do? Is he going to act out? Is he going to have a bad day? Is he going to end up crying? All those things go through my head. And so now it's a lot calmer. Now him going to a friend's house, I don't worry that he's going to get sent home because he bit somebody or hit somebody.
That I can hear the relief in your voice. I absolutely do. Dr. Fitzgerald, how much difference can early diagnosis of anxiety and then treatment make in a child's long-term outcome? I guess I'm wondering, is there any downside to a child being seen and diagnosed at a very early age?
I think it's so important for kids to get treated, diagnosed at an early age. It can make a world of difference. We know that preschool-age children who are already experiencing anxiety are at risk for a host of things, not only persistent anxiety, but also substance abuse, depression, even increases suicide risk. So in this case with Oliver, you know, it may be that he continues to grow in his ability to manage his anxiety, but by doing that early, it really shifts his trajectory so he can be successful and, you know, get to his fullest potential.
So are there more camp sessions this summer?
Yes, we have an additional camp at the end of August. The way we run camp is it takes place over two mornings, a Saturday and a Sunday, and then a subsequent Saturday and Sunday. So two weekends back to back. And in fact, partly based on Melissa's feedback, after this session, we will be running more camps throughout the year in the fall and the winter, and we'll be stretching that camp out over a little bit longer period, a full month, and working more to involve parents.
And age-wise, who's eligible? What's your target group?
4 to 6-year-old kids. So this is an opportunity to kind of get that anxiety under control before they launch to kindergarten.
Melissa, what would you say to a parent of a preschooler who is where you were with Oliver, watching and worrying about a child's behavior and his moods?
I think it's twofold for me because as a parent, you internalize everything and wonder what you did wrong and whether you're alone. So I would let them know that they're not alone. And to look into Kid Power and to look into different resources out there that can help you and get help, because it's nothing to be shameful of. I can remember being shameful when daycare would call and being upset. And now I look back on it and realize that he was struggling. He was having his own trouble, and he needed some help. And the different things that we've come across, and especially Kid Power, have been so helpful in not just how much help it has been to us, but how much help it has been to him, and him seeing we don't have to have a fit to break through. We can calm ourselves down and we can come back to the situation, and it doesn't have to end the game. It doesn't have to end the fun.
Well, it certainly seems like Camp Kid Power has been a game changer for your son, Oliver. And we want to thank you for sharing your story and Oliver's story with us, Melissa Bollinger, and Dr. Kate Fitzgerald, psychiatrist with the University of Michigan. And we have put a link on the stateside page at michiganradio.org where you can get information on Camp Kid Power. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having me.
If you find yourself in Grand Haven this week, be prepared. The 12th annual Michigan Pirate Festival is happening Tuesday through Saturday. Grand Haven will be happily invaded by fun-loving pirates. Larry Halverson is with the Loudoun District Library, which is hosting the festival. And Stella Durham is with the Brethren of the Great Lakes. And when she is in full pirate garb and character, she is Admiral Morgan. Ahoy and welcome.
Ahoy there, love.
Good to have you with us. Larry, what kinds of things happen in Grand Haven during the Michigan Pirate Festival?
Well, we have arts and pirate arts and crafts. We have belly dancing, a lot of story times and pirate puppet shows. We have a pillaging with pirates, sea shanties, sing-alongs.
So it's just a lot of fun. And Admiral Morgan, what brought you to the pirate's life and to the Brethren of the Great Lakes?
Oh, my goodness. So that would take a long time to explain, but very simply, my ship came in, and I said, all right, I'm coming over to Grand Haven, and we're going to do powdered monkey Olympics and pillaging with pirates, and we're going to teach all the monkeys how to do things aboard ship. So it's just fun. Fun and games. That's all we want to do is play. We love it.
Tell us about the Brethren of the Great Lakes. What's this group about?
Oh, the Brethren is a group of like-minded individuals who kind of get together, play pirate, and do fun activities together. We're from all over, most the Midwest, Michigan. We've got about 400 of us. You've got some reenactment type stuff. You've got some people who do the Jack Sparrow and Errol Flynn with the panache. And you've got people who kind of take the two and gel them together. And we educate people on piracy.
How active were pirates on the Great Lakes? I mean, we see Captain Jack Sparrow, you know, and everybody thinks of him. That, of course, fictional story set in the Caribbean. How about the Great Lakes?
One that comes to mind is Roaring Dan Seavey. And he was legendary for getting ships to shipwreck on the shoals and then pillage their ships. A lot of it had to do with logging. So it's not so much the gold and the shinies, but it had to do more with taking over ships and then taking over the cargo of logging all the wood products.
Admiral Morgan, you'll be very happy to know we actually did a whole segment on CV right on this show.
Excellent. Very good. Well, then, you're well versed. Quite nicely done. I like that.
There you go.
That's great.
Do you see yourself more as a reenactor or more as an educator, Admiral Morgan?
A bit of both. Each one of us has a different forte. My father, Henry Morgan, yes, that one, yes. I'm an expert on Henry Morgan. I'm an expert on the Widder, which is a shipwreck, Stamp Bellamy's shipwreck. And then we love dealing with kids. You know, we love giving out treasure. That's the funniest thing about us with the Brethren. We like to give more than we take. How's that?
And you're very. And I know you're busy all year round with lots of activities. And I'm interested, what does Stella Durham love about being Admiral Morgan?
Honestly, when I'm the character, you put the hat on and you become a different person. And I like that person because it's a lot freer than the person I am in normal life, you know? I can do a lot more things and have a lot more fun. It gives you a little bit of a variety and a little bit of spice of life, which I think really, really gives us all a bit of longevity in this life. You know, as it were, you could say, hey, I've got a new lease on life. I'm a lot more lively, you know. I just do different things. So many people go through life with one hobby or another, and they don't get to meet a lot of different people. I love what I do. I get to meet so many people from so many walks of life. It's fantastic.
Larry Halverson, what are you hoping visitors to the Laudit District Library in Grand Haven are going to get out of the Michigan Pirate Festival this week?
I hope they come up with an understanding that they can still pretend. They can go outside of their own personality and pretend that they are a pirate. And a lot of these are kids-oriented programs, but that's true for us adults, too, that we forget that we have a kid inside of all of us.
The 12th Annual Michigan Pirate Festival invades Grand Haven, beginning tomorrow, running through Saturday. And we've got a link for information at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Larry Halverson and Admiral Morgan, a.k.a. Stella Durham, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.